Hello, dear friends. Welcome to the Principled Podcast. From the work we do with hundreds of school leaders around the globe, it is becoming clearer and clearer to us at Making Stuff Better that a new way of thinking is needed in order to meet the needs of a rapidly changing world. The challenge and opportunity for us at MSB is always this: how can we help leaders in schools develop new ways of thinking that align with the emergent reality of life in the 21st century? If we accept that a new way of thinking is needed, which we do, and that educators are pivotal in creating the conditions for change that are so needed in the world, then what are the implications for school leaders as they continue to grow learning communities that thrive? It's a big question. So for this second season, we're going to refine our quest and focus specifically on systemic and organizational health. What is it? What does it feel like? How do you create it? And what matters about it? And how might thinking from a systemic perspective help us in the challenges I've just outlined? We're not looking for a single answer. As Meg Wheatley rightly says, everyone in a complex system has a slightly different interpretation. The more interpretations we gather, the easier it becomes to gain a sense of the whole. So, gather interpretations we will. Join us in this second season where we will draw on wisdom of leaders from the worlds of ecology, systems thinking, poetry, dendrology, that's the study of trees, I had to look it up, and many, many more. This season is a series of journeys we will take to explore what organisational health means in a school in the 21st century. It's by me, Matt Hall, and my friend and colleague, Naomi Ward, powered by Making Stuff Better. Hello, Naomi Ward. Here we are again, another week of the Principled Podcast.
Yes, another week and another angle on organisational health and thinking more systemically. And I had a conversation with Dee Lanier because I was really interested in his approach to designing learning experiences for adults and for young people. And that conversation made me think, be great to get him on the Principled Podcast to share not only his wisdom, but also who he is, because he's such a warm, open, curious person, human being. Yeah, so looking forward to it as ever.
Yeah, likewise, and read a little bit about his work, in particular his book, Demarginalizing Design, and there's a line in there around, we need to learn to get out of the text and into the margins. That tickled me, kind of curious to hear more about that. Yeah, let's have a listen.
Okay, let's go. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Principled Podcast. I'm here with my good friend and colleague, Matt Hall, and really happy to welcome Dee Lanier here. And Dee, if you don't mind, I just wanted to share something that I read about you recently, which echoes with my experience of you, which is someone said about you, my heart and creativity are inspired and full, ready to design in the world with courage and joy. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I believe I know where that very flattering quote came from. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I'm sure our listeners will feel the same. But yeah, so as our listeners know, the context for this season is the elements that support organizational health, which requires a mindset of thinking more systemically. So perhaps first question is, tell us a little bit about the work you do and where it might fit into that context.
Well, I do a few different things in supporting schools and school leaders. First and foremost, I am a coach, education coach. And so I do a lot of work with Samsung Education and helping schools implement technology in meaningful ways. Additionally, I tend to come in as a coach or a consultant for helping schools adopt new policies that they have created. And that is accomplished by doing some workshop facilitation, design thinking around social challenges that exist not only within their community, but not speaking to not only their community broadly, but their immediate community, things that affect them. And then looking at some of those issues and providing feedback to administration on the challenges that seem to be most pertinent to their staff and their rationales to why, and then giving them helpful feedback on how to create an environment of change and development.
So I'm hearing that it's kind of important to you, if you're going to create change, to really find out what's there in the environment.
Yes, exactly. It's incredibly important to find out what matters to them. And I find often that administration may have a particular goal or desire in mind. And I think that's good. But I also aim to help them recognize that there may be a disconnect between what they recognize as the primary challenges that exist and what their community recognizes as the primary challenges. And so how to bridge that gap becomes the longer work, because sometimes the perceived challenges are due to, you know, just what administration sees or what they hear or what they feel, but that can be different than the practitioner and what they see and what they experience, right? Additionally, there may be an initiative that is brought upon a school community, and that initiative becomes what everyone is concerned about and what needs to be addressed. At the same time, there may be other challenges that exist that are really, really pervasive. And if those aren't addressed, then you can't tackle the other things. And so recognizing how the culture is operating, how people feel as a community participant, and then making sure that we sort of lower the barriers that exist between communication of staff and administration. And in many ways, making that a model for how teachers are creating that same sort of cultural connection point and conversations with students. And so it really is a holistic community change approach, but it is something that requires longer term investment, though I may come in really just to help expose a community for what their needs are. And if they're willing to go deeper, then we can do some goal setting and some action planning and do some longer development. And that's very much something I enjoy doing.
I'm curious, Dee, as given your background, whether that you're coming to that with a specific methodology or approach or discipline in mind.
Matt, I feel like you already know the answer to this question, but I appreciate you asking it for sure. So I was introduced to design thinking or human-centered design in 2015, and that became a journey for me in diving deep into understanding a framework of design thinking, which is, if you're not familiar with design thinking, number one, I'm going to qualify it right now as a mindset before it is a model. So it is a mindset. If you consider how designers think of various disciplines, but designers tend to stop, pause, and ask questions to seek to understand what they don't completely understand. They may have certain biases. They have certain desires. They have things that they may have preferences for, but they recognize that their goal is to understand what others want and then meld their expertise with the expertise of the people who are affected by whatever decisions are made. And so that is a mindset that is prevalent in all forms of design. And then secondly, there's a model that can be utilized for moving from point A to point, and I would say more like from A to D or E. And I say that because oftentimes, and I think about this in particular in schools, we consider a problem and then we move straight to what are some solutions and then let's implement. And whatever mistakes that happen along the way, we'll excuse them. We don't necessarily take enough time to ask enough questions in advance to get at the deeper heart of the issue, to understand the complexity of it. And then after even attempting to implement whatever solutions that we may have come up with, still putting that on trial and evaluating how's it going, what changes might need to be made in order to improve upon the situation. And so design thinking is oftentimes looked at as a five-step process, but I think it's first a mindset. And then secondly, it is utilizing that process for the sake of continuing to learn and improve.
Yeah, with that in mind, and it is a process that is new to me. Can you give us some examples of what that might look like in a school setting?
Sure. So I'm going to give a couple more qualifications. The first one is a reminder that design thinking is a mindset first and not a process or a model. But with that being said, there are various models that are more familiar in educational settings. I would say the one model that is probably most prevalent or most known in education settings is Stanford D School's design thinking model, which was originally established in, I want to say, 2005. That being said, that five-step process has been kind of used in education regularly. And I like to remember it as every day is party time. And so starting with empathy, which I love this approach, which is to say every problem affects people. And so we need to first recognize who are the people that are affected by whatever the problem is and really aim to understand what they're feeling. My one little footnote about starting with empathy is that in all honesty, we recognize a problem because it's been brought to our attention. And so I love the discipline of saying we're going to start with empathy. We're going to start with people. But the reality is that there's already been a problem of some sort that has been expressed. Now we've caught hold of there's a problem. Okay, let's find out who these people are and who it affects and think through their lens. And that also includes actually speaking to them and getting to know and understand how a problem affects them. And so in a school setting, this could be something you can call it as small or as big as how a student or how a group of students are dealing with a dress code policy, right? That could be a problem that is perceived by students. And then that same problem can be perceived differently by parents. And that same problem can be perceived differently by teachers and administration. And so starting with empathy, knowing who you are aiming to problem solve with is the language I like to use versus for, and then going into then clearly defining the problem is what Stanford D School's model would be. And then ideation is a coined term for coming up with as many ideas as possible to address a problem. And then every day is, okay, see, that's me just reminding myself the next point, and that is prototyping. So then coming up with some creative solutions and then testing that solution. And so it could look like a dress code policy that, you know, that disallows students from wearing hoodies on their head because it's distracted in learning, and all different community members look at it differently. But at the end, completely different policy may come to be because community members, including the students, got to speak into it as to how that policy affects them. So that is an example of using a process. But that's just me going off the top of my dome. But I utilize a student-centered process, or I should say a process that I co-developed with students that is very much creative and gamified and sort of fun, and is called Solve in Time. But there are various processes that exist. I think the biggest thing is recognizing that you have to engage the community that's affected by the problem and not solve problems for people, but with them.
Hello friends, it's Matt here, just interrupting your podcast to let you know that if you're enjoying the nature of the guests and the conversations, then there's plenty more to get involved in over at MSB. We run a symposium series. These are interactive, live, online workshops, two or three times a term, where we invite speakers from the podcast and beyond to come and work directly with school leaders and educators around the world. They're small groups, no more than 40 normally in a session, and they are really, really engaging and stimulating ways of thinking and reflecting on your leadership. All you have to do is head over to makingstuffbetter.com/symposium, and you can sign up for 1, 2, 3, as many of them as you like. And we'd love to see you there. That's makingstuffbetter.com/symposium. They really, really are
exciting and engaging workshops from a range of really interesting and different speakers. Hope to see you there. On with the podcast.
Clear that this co part of, I noticed on your website, a lot of verbs have the prefix of co, like you do this process with others. And, you know, Matt and I, we've all worked in schools, haven't we, where there's a real action bias. And I notice even in your presence, you serve to slow things down. So I imagine that echoes through the people you work with. And I guess I'm curious about you and what's important to you in this way of viewing community, change, co-creation. Where is that in you, kind of in your purpose and how you move through the world, I guess?
I appreciate that. Well, I have to be completely honest in that I am a talker and I am one who would likely in a room be the first to raise their hand when I have an opinion. But I remember, this is indelible to me. I remember way, way back in the day when I was an undergraduate and I was in a critical pedagogy class and I made some form of like stump speech to the rest of my classmates about we're all, you know, aiming to be educators, but I see that there are a lot of people that are in the room that are really, really quiet and don't say anything concerning these issues that are really, really important. And then again, this was a critical pedagogy class. And so we were reading works such as Paulo Freire, and we were talking about how the educational system as it is currently designed can very much be harmful to students and various reasons why. And so I was sort of emotionally charged up. And this one classmate looked at me very politely. She was so kind, but she said, "Some of us need time to process and think. And it would be helpful if we were given room to speak." And that just floored me because she was speaking to somebody who was just full of hubris in the moment. And I was really hyped. And I thought, I'm here to motivate these people who seem to be really, really quiet and don't want to take action now. And just her words of some of us need time to process and given more space so that we can speak. And I just took that as a very loving correction. And I have not done my best at applying that advice at all times. But I think eventually, especially in the classroom setting, when I was a classroom teacher, I started to recognize that the goal of all of this really is to empower the learners. And so I have to get out of the way. And in order to get out of the way, I have to stop talking. And in order to do that, I have to give them something that they want to talk about. And I need to allow them the space to talk about it to one another in smaller groups, give them opportunity to process in various ways. And at the same time, of course, we're all confined by time restrictions. And so I have to still model this classroom and the objectives of the day from whenever the bell rings at the beginning to when it concludes. So I still have to do all of that management. But when I take a step back, I realize my job is really to be a facilitator. And I will have lots of opportunity to share my opinion and my wisdom from my experience, because I still have the authority, so to speak, as their teacher. I still have the ability to kind of stop the whole room and say something globally. I still have that, but what would it look like if I were to actually change what this whole dynamic looks like so that students, and that was my first goal, can have time to process and to speak with one another and then share out as they feel in various ways. And then where can I be actually surprised by what I hear versus me aiming to get from them what I gave them? So that became a challenge in the classroom, and it very much became a challenge in my professional development facilitation. And it's the challenge that I absolutely love and welcome today, because there is more brilliance in the room if we actually give them room to express it.
Yeah, really resonate with so much of what you say and what I think my aspirations were as a teacher. And it's exciting to hear you convene that space. And I guess if we go back to thinking about systems, you know, we have this principle that, you know, a small is a reflection of the large. So I'm wondering, you know, your hopes for if young people can convene like that and be surprising and extend their thinking, how are you seeing that ripple out into the world?
Well, that's the goal. The rippling out to the world is definitely the goal. And part of how I attempt to do that is by connecting to the passions of the people that I am facilitating a discussion and problem-solving process with. And I don't mean that just wide open. I mean that somewhat directed, in that Solving Time as a process in which I utilize started very much as an amalgam of 20% time, if you're familiar with that concept, of passion projects and social justice. And here's what I mean. In that 20% time or passion projects often look like, allow a student 20% of their time to kind of explore whatever they want and to share their learning in the process. And that's great. But then how do we connect to the real needs that are surrounding them and really help students become, you know, global citizens? If that's what many educators, and I've been polling educators for years now and asking, like, why did you ever get into this? And in summary, most educators say that they got into education because they want to make an impact on students to make them better citizens for society. And I'm like, okay, if that is it, if that's your why, no matter how far you've drifted due to various challenges that exist, if that's your why, then if we can bring it back there and then aim for the students' why, like, why do they care about certain things? And then how can they connect their passions to problems that exist, and how could they actually potentially be a part of the solution? And so it may be awesome that a student loves to play the piano and they want to do a passion project sharing about their journey in learning music. But then I also want to connect to, do they care about the homeless that they see on their walk to school on a daily basis? And the answer is yes. Then how might they come up with a solution for said problem of homelessness that potentially incorporates music? Now, what they come up with as a result of that may completely blow me and everyone else away because it was imaginative and it didn't already exist. Or maybe it's partnering with an organization that is doing something that is similar to their passions, serving the community, that is also connected to a problem that they recognize as extremely burdensome and that they want to see it resolved prayerfully in their lifetime. And that there's an organization that's local that they can partner with and connect to and either volunteer for or just learn more about and maybe even be a part of promoting their existence. And that sort of thing is really my heartbeat. And when I get to hear and see in ways that students are doing that, and then of course, as teachers become more like action advisors, if you will, and helping and support them in doing that, then all of the sort of content that they're also learning and all of the skills that they're learning from their core classes are also being integrated in that work. That's when I get most excited, when I get to see it happening and hear of how it is happening across the globe, all because a teacher was willing to utilize a process that connects passions with problems. And that's what gets me most excited, when I get to hear of those examples that are still happening today.
You know, so many of our listeners will resonate with that. And I think, you know, you're kind of reminding us about the reasons why people go into education in the first place, and then illustrating it so nicely with that example of how it might be possible. I'm wondering what I guess my I always do this. I put myself into the shoes of someone listening who's feeling the pressure of the system, the education system, the examination system, the curriculum, the expectations around what needs to be delivered in a typical international school. All of the in and out of systems that can sometimes feel like they constrain people leading in these settings. You have that desire that you described, but somehow feel like the system is not in flow. The system's against them. I'm not going to be kind of trite enough to say, what's the answer? But I'm just curious about what comes up for you as I ask that question.
Yeah, well, a few things come to mind. Number one is recognizing that we're all bound by various constraints. And I think that there's a difference between constraint and restraint. If you're in an environment where you are restrained, where you actually are told, no, you can't on a regular basis, that's being restrained. When you have something to give and offer, but you are told that you absolutely cannot. That's tough, but constraints are oftentimes just looked at as confines. And the first one being time, right? Like, I don't have enough time to do this. I don't have enough time to do that. Oftentimes in the work that I do, there's a term used, and that is creative constraint. Like, so what are the constraints that exist that you have to be creative within? So that's acknowledging that some constraints are frustrating, but I also think about, and this is just the way my brain works. So if you're like, D, not everyone is going to understand or acknowledge or vibe with you on that particular thing. I'm just letting you know the way that I think my mind works. And, you know, there are various activities and sports that have boundaries and say, okay, here are the lines, you must stay within them. Here are the rules, you must do it only within this way. So then the question becomes, out of all those athletes that are playing that particular sport, they are all having to abide by certain rules that feel very constraining, because it would be very much easier if, right, there was no out of bounds. It'd be easier if there was no offsides. It'd be easy if you could tackle this way versus being told you can't that way. But here's the thing. We do know at least that everyone has been given the same rules, at least they're supposed to have all been given the same rules. Now, how can we be creative within those rules to actually execute and win? And there's a lot of creativity that can still exist within those boundaries. And so there's no easy answer, but it's the figuring it out is, for me, that becomes the first challenge. Okay, how can I work within these constraints? Let me give an example that's very pertinent in the United States. So using the term equity in various states in the United States is taboo now, more than taboo. It's actually outlawed in certain districts. Well, that's kind of hard for somebody like me who wants to come in and elevate equity in problem solving. So I have a new constraint. I can't in certain places use the word equity. But what I can do is survey and learn what a community cares about and why. And then I can use the terms that are necessary to describe what those things are. And I can ask the community to share with me what those terms are and what they feel about them and how they connect to them. Right. So in that way, I can be more like an investigative journalist to understand what they are feeling and what they are sensing. And in that way, I can actually have lots of freedom, because it's not about me necessarily building upon someone's lexicon of terminology. But instead, the goal is to actually solve problems. And so if I can understand whatever the constraints are in the or the restraints in certain instances are, but then be creative within it to still accomplish the goal. We need to identify what problems exist, and we need to do our best to solve them. And in doing that, it's going to require a certain level of patience and a mindset of getting very proximate to the pain that exists, having deep humility, because you may be an outsider to the people groups that are affected by whatever said problem. And last but not least, aiming to be insatiably curious. And so asking questions and knowing how to ask questions and what questions to ask and who may respond differently to whatever those questions are, and listen for why whatever problems that exist matter so much to them, are just examples of ways that we can just at least open our aperture to thinking differently about whatever problems exist, what constraints exist, what things that seem to be limiting us and holding us back from engaging certain things in the ways that we want to. Instead saying, if this is still a problem, then we have to solve it. Let's kind of methodically go through this as a community, and then allow people to deal with data would be my final statement in that regard. So wherever I can bring research to the table and then data with outcomes, then if there are authorities that still want to suppress whatever solutions people are coming up with, I've at least given them all of the research and the data that explains why they should be doing it differently. And then what that community does with that can be powerful.
I'm just struck by the rarity in the quality of conversation you're offering, how much awareness and energy must be released in that part of the process. So I sort of mentioned courage and joy at the beginning of the conversation, and I sort of feel that energy here in your determination to kind of operate within the cracks of constraint. Like, what a powerful example. Yeah, thank you so much for your time, Dee, in this conversation. It's been really wonderful to hear about your work and your passion.
Well, thank you, Naomi. This is the work that I think that we need to all continue to do, and that is taking a deep breath, breathing through the challenges that exist around us and that we are confronting on a daily basis, aiming to understand the perspective of others and listening intently to how they are being affected by various things, and then being very deliberate in seeking for change. And that can be a learning process for everyone. But if schools aren't for learning how to overcome challenges, then I do not understand what schools are for at all.
What a great place to leave it. Thanks. Thanks so much, Dee. Go well.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks so much.
That was a really interesting conversation. I really enjoyed it. It was a real reminder to me that I know I really hear that he really approaches some difficult topics and really works with communities to kind of go and kind of lift the bonnet on what maybe feels difficult or not quite easy. And a real reminder to me that this stuff is messy, that it's not all nice, neat philosophies and principles and approaches that are easily executed, because if it were, then we probably wouldn't need them. But actually, you know, you've got to work at organization and systemic health, and it's difficult work and challenging work, but important work.
Yeah, and you could also hear joy that he's having in those conversations, and that you can imagine that is there as people have insights, as they explore what is the real problem here and what do our stakeholders have to say. And so I think that sense of, if you're leading for systemic change or organizational health, it is a mindset shift, which I think releases us from some of that frustration with process. So definitely taking away, you know, thinking about stakeholders, spending more time on what is the problem. Other guests have spoken about that. And also working within the system and the creativity that's available there. And just really energizing young people to be activists in their communities, those systems beyond school. I feel really inspired.
You know, sometimes it's the most simple things that are most useful, isn't it? I found that distinction between constraint and restraint really helpful, just a way of thinking about that. Because often it's really easy in any work to think, oh, I can't do that. I'm not being allowed to do that. But often I don't think it is. I think restraint, we often think it's restraint, but actually it's constraint. And actually sometimes those guidelines.
In that example, there's that mindset shift was really illustrated. So for our listeners who would like to follow up on Dee's work, do check out Solve in Time, his kind of structured enough thinking process to get young people thinking about real world problems, also Demarginalizing Design, a recent book Dee has published. And you can also find out all about him at lanierlearning.com.
Great stuff. See you next time.
Thank you for coming along with us on this principled journey. To learn more about making stuff better and how we can help you and leaders in your school, please do get in touch through hello@makingstuffbetter.com. Alternatively, you can find us in all the usual places like LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Links are in the show notes below. And don't forget to subscribe, and if you can, leave us a review. That's all for now. See you next time.